Good morning, friends.
Good morning.
If you've been paying attention to the news at all recently, you know that we've had a visitor here in the U.S. And I really like this picture because you have the Pope and then you have Republican Speaker of the House, John Boehner, and Democratic Vice President Joe Biden, and they're both Catholic, and they're both excited to have the Pope with them. And Pope Francis was given this historic opportunity to be the first sitting Pope to address a joint session of Congress. And it seems like he really took advantage of that opportunity in his own gentle but prophetic way. Pope Francis called out some of the systemic sins of our country, but he also called forth the best of our values and ideals as a country, and he used four people from American history to illustrate that. So who can name the four people from American history that he named?
Abraham Lincoln,
Dorothy Day,
Thomas Merton,
one more. Martin Luther King. Good job. Of all the ones to forget, that's a fun. But yes, excellent. Good job, Sean. And you've been out of the country too. That's impressive. So. I was really excited to hear one of those names in particular, Thomas Merton. How many of you have heard of Thomas Merton or familiar with him? Okay, quite a few of you. I was excited to hear Merton's name because Thomas Merton has been an important person in my own spiritual development and my own thinking. And I never would have guessed that his name would be mentioned in Congress, or that a contemplative would be praised in Congress. And so I was really excited about that. And one of the things that Thomas Merton asked us to think about, to consider, is the relationship between contemplation and action, between action and contemplation. What is that relationship? Is one more Christ-like than the other? Should we emphasize or prioritize one over the other? These are questions that I've been asking for a long time, and they're also questions that Quakers have been asking for a long time. Throughout history, there have been times where Quakers really emphasized waiting on the Lord and don't do anything unless you are completely confident that God is leading you to do it. And then there's been other times where Quakers have emphasized getting involved in social causes and working toward justice and peace. An illustration of this, this holding those two things together is that Quakers have sometimes admonished each other by saying, "Be careful that you don't run ahead of the guide or lag behind." I think that's a really good question. And in this series we're doing about living the questions, there's a question that we've had as part of Northwest Yearly Meeting that relates to that running ahead or lagging behind of the guide. And it says, the query is, how does your inward life turn outward? How does your inward life turn outward? So there's this inward life, and there's this outward life. There's contemplation, and there's action. And sometimes it's tricky holding those two together because by nature, we gravitate more toward one or the other. And so, for example, I'm more of a contemplative by nature. So when I hear this phrase, contemplation and action, I read it, contemplation and action. How many of you are more drawn to the contemplative side of our faith. Okay? Yeah. Now, there are others of us who are more active by nature, kind of the Nike philosophy, just do it. And so when you hear this phrase, you read it, contemplation and action. Sounds kind of like a movie director or something. So how many of you are more on the active side of things? Okay, yeah. And then there's the philosophy of Richard Rohr, who he a while back started a retreat center, and he called it the Center for Action and Contemplation. And he said the most important word in that title is not action or contemplation, but and. There's a sense of, you know, holding these together. There's a sense of balance and all that kind of thing. Although he also said that as a culture, we are more active, and so maybe we need to emphasize a little bit more of the contemplative side. So already we've talked about Pope Francis, Thomas Merton, and Richard Rohr. But there's another great guy named Jesus of Nazareth that I'd also like to talk about, who also wrestled with this tension of contemplation and action. And there's a story I've been drawn to when I think about this, and it's actually stories in the gospel about Jesus feeding crowds of people. And so I want to look at those, one of those today, and so I'll be referencing a version of the story found in Mark chapter 6. The story begins when Jesus invites his disciples into solitude, to go into more of a contemplative space. It says, the apostles gathered around Jesus and reported to him all they had done and taught. So they had been very busy in ministry. Then, because so many people were coming and going that they did not even have a chance to eat, Jesus said to them, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. And I think that most of us are familiar with that feeling of life being so full of comings and goings and people and needs and expectations that we realize we haven't even had the chance to eat, or we haven't even had the chance to rest. And in other words, we're so busy taking care of other people that we aren't able to take care of ourselves. So this isn't a new problem. It happens in the Gospels repeatedly. And so Jesus knows there's times where he needs to retreat into that space of solitude, a quiet place to get some rest. And so Jesus is inviting the disciples into that here, and I can imagine them being really relieved at that time. I mean, you can imagine in your own life where you finally get a break. You know, you finally get to eat, and it's like the best meal of your life, and you just crash and get some solid sleep. But in this story, there's a but. It says, but many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So Jesus began teaching them many things. So I got to be honest, just in reading this story, I am annoyed at a couple of things. First of all, I'm annoyed at the people who ran ahead to hijack this retreat. And second of all, honestly, I'm annoyed at Jesus that he gives in to them. It feels unbalanced. I mean, Jesus and the disciples had been busy. They'd been giving so much to so many people in so many different ways. And so now was the time to go rest and retreat. And in other gospel stories, Jesus doesn't give in to the crowds. Jesus was what we might call a self-differentiated person. He didn't give in to the anxiety of the crowds and what people expected, but he made decisions from this place of discernment and intentionality. So why is this different? Well, I don't know, but there is a clue in the passage. There's this pivotal word that moves Jesus from this posture of contemplation to this posture of action. And that word is compassion. Compassion is the bridge between contemplation and action. But I think that compassion is something we've been tempted to define in a very narrow way. We think compassion is feeling sad or bad for someone in a difficult situation, having sympathy for them. And those are good things, but I think the biblical idea is much larger than that. I've been helped by a description from Marcus Borg, who is a biblical scholar who actually just passed away recently. And he provides this description of compassion. And I'm going to read it and then let you sit with it and ask what you notice about this quote, maybe what's similar or different to how you've heard compassion described. Borg says, "Compassion is the central virtue of a life centered in God as known in Jesus. When Jesus, in a few words, summarized theology and ethics, the character of God and how we should live, he said, 'Be compassionate as God is compassionate.' In Hebrew and Aramaic, compassion is related to the word for womb. God is womb-like, giving birth to us, nourishing us, and feels for us in the whole of creation, as a mother feels for the children of her womb, willing our well-being and sometimes becoming fierce when our well-being and the well-being of creation is threatened. We are to be compassionate as God is compassionate. Importantly, compassion is not only a feeling, but a doing. The imperative is not simply to feel compassion, but to be compassionate, to act in accordance with that feeling." So looking at that, what do you notice about that description, and how is that maybe similar or different to how you've seen compassion?
It doesn't have beginning or end. It's a relationship.
The compassion is a relationship that doesn't have beginning or end. The centering. Yeah, it's this virtue of a life centered in God. Yeah.
But if I heard your question correctly, it seems what stands out is compassion is not just feeling compassion for someone, but also being.
Yeah.
Contemplating what you're going to do and doing the compassion.
Yeah. Yeah, not just feeling compassionate, but doing something in response. Yeah.
It feels very safe.
Yeah. Holding somebody in a safe place, like a womb, the same way that God holds us.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, so it's not that God's getting something out of it so much as giving and helping you emerge and become, maybe.
Was it? Yeah.
Yeah, not just to care, but to protect and defend like a mama bear. Yeah, that's that word fierce in this quote I really liked, because it brings out this, expands our understanding of compassion, that it's not just feeling with, but it is that. It's solidarity in action. It's gentle, but also fierce. It's personal and it's political. Compassion is inspired by caring for individuals, but also caring about their social system. So Jesus was moved by compassion because he saw that the people were like sheep without a shepherd. And so the people that were supposed to be shepherding them, providing them loving leadership and just rulership, were not doing their job. And this was unacceptable to Jesus. Last Wednesday, we started our Quaker advocacy group, and we were talking about what are right motivations for action. And we had a really interesting discussion about the place of anger. Some of us were saying anger is counterproductive and destructive. And others of us were talking about how anger is energizing and healthy. I mean, after all, Jesus got angry, and think of his demonstration in the temple. But anger is something we tend to be uncomfortable with as Quakers. I know it's not my favorite emotion to deal with, but it made me think and wonder if sometimes anger is even a form of compassion. It's an expression of our desire for justice and our impulse to protect the most vulnerable. So Jesus is moved with this compassion and begins to teach them. And that's what they needed. But before long, they needed something more, something very basic but very important. They needed food. And listen to the contrast between how Jesus and the disciples respond. By this time, it was late in the day, so his disciples came to Jesus. "This is a remote place," they said, "and it's already very late. Send the people away so that they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." But Jesus answered, "You give them something to eat." They said to him, "That would take more than a half a year's wages. Are we going to go and spend that much on bread and give them something to eat? How many loaves do you have?" Jesus asked, "Go and see." When they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. So disciples wanted to send the crowds away to take responsibility for their own lives. But Jesus turns it around and asks them to be responsible also. And the disciples are understandably perplexed and frustrated. They're probably hangry at this point because they haven't eaten either, as far as I can tell. I imagine them saying, "What do you want from us? You're a great guy, Jesus, and your compassion is inspiring. But at a certain point, it's just about the money. And we don't have it." And I really identify with the disciples at this point. Not just because I'm broke a lot, but this sense of standing before this great crowd of so much need and hunger and suffering and feeling like I'm not adequate to help them. The disciples are interpreting the situation through this narrative of scarcity, while Jesus is interpreting it through the narrative of abundance. There is enough. God is enough. You are enough. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looking up to heaven, Jesus gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people. He also divided the 2 fish among them all. They all ate and were satisfied. The disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces of bread and fish. Realizing the reign of God involves a partnership with God, God's friends across the globe. But we do have a part in that partnership. And when we each do our part, we see miracles happen. Even better, we get to participate in making miracles happen. There's always enough when we share our gifts, when we do our part, when we're willing to be broken, blessed, and given. Not only enough, but more than enough. Abundance. Maybe the point isn't to prioritize contemplation or action, or try to find the perfect balance of the two. But maybe the organizing principle is faithfulness, which encompasses both contemplation and action in different ways at different times. This gospel story has a lot of Eucharistic imagery. And I have to admit that even as a good Quaker, and I love the simplicity of Quaker meeting, I also love liturgy, and in particular, receiving the Eucharist. And so sometimes I'll go to more of a high church place to experience that. A few months ago, I went to a Catholic Mass in McMinnville. It's one of those rare Catholic churches that allows us wayward Protestants to receive the Eucharist, and from a female priest, no less. It's a very interesting church. And so it came to that point where we're invited to come up and receive the elements, and as I'm standing in line, I hear the people in front of me, you know, going up, signing themselves, opening their hands, and the priest lifts up the bread and says, "This is the body of Christ. Take and eat." So I heard this several times over, and so when I got up there, I expected to hear the same. So I go up, sign myself, open my hands. She lifts up the bread, looks me in the eye, and says, "Andy, you are the body of Christ." And it was a beautiful and profound moment for me. And I think a really good expression of Quaker theology also. We are the body of Christ. We are nourishment and abundance for a hungry world. And there's always enough when we are willing to be broken, blessed, and shared. So I want to enter into a few minutes of open worship to open up into that contemplative, active space. And I'm going to close with a poem from Sister Simone Campbell, sometimes known as the Nun on the Bus. There's an interesting story about her, but I'll just read this poem and we'll listen for Christ. I always joked that the miracle of loaves and fish was sharing. The women always knew this, but in the moment of need and notoriety, I ache, tremble, almost weep at folks so hungry, malnourished, faced with spiritual famine of epic proportions. My heart aches with their need. Apostle-like, I whine, what are we among so many? The consistent 2,000-year-old ever new response is, blessed and broken, you are enough.